I'm Sherry Harbaugh, and today's last topic in the series of five on singleness is entitled Singleness, Aging, and Economics. And I assume that most of you have assumed that this session will be coupling those two things, aging and economics, and for the most part, that's what we'll be doing, is just primarily looking at aging and economics. However, we'll be looking a little bit at just aging, especially at the during the second part of this piece, and particularly as it applies to singleness. I also wanted to be sure, for those of you who attended my first session on singleness, intimacy, and community, also the one yesterday on singleness and grief, that you were aware that some of the material that I was using was taken from Virginia Satir's book, The New People Making, or even the old one that was published in 1972. It was just called People Making. And also some of the things, particularly the self-esteem maintenance kit. Remember the detective's hat and the medallion and the courage of wishing stick and the golden key and the wisdom box. That was all taken not from the book, but from the seminars that I attended that Virginia Satir had done many years ago. I spent about 3 weeks with Virginia Satir in British Columbia about 4.5 years ago, and so a lot of the material that I use has been adapted or somehow taken from what I've learned from her over the years. Not all of it is published, not all of it's written down. Much of it is verbal interchange or just what I have perceived from that. But I did want to acknowledge that much of it is taken from Virginia Satir. And the book is available in the bookstore and also in the library. Okay. The other thing that I wanted to do is read a poem that was given to me right before I came to Holden, but I can't find the source of it, so I know this is not really ethical to read something that I'm not acknowledging the source, but somehow I will try to get this acknowledged. But it seemed to tie in so nicely with what we finished up yesterday with singleness and grief, and move into the transition into this day with singleness, aging, and economics. So I thought I'd read this as sort of a transition. It's called What Can I Believe? Oh God, I am so fragile. My dreams get broken. My relationships get broken. My heart gets broken. My body gets broken. What can I believe except that you will not despise a broken heart, that old and broken people shall yet dream dreams, and that the lame shall leap for joy, the blind see, the deaf hear. What can I believe except what Jesus taught, that only what is first broken like bread can be shared, that only what is broken is open to your entry, that old wineskins must be ripped open and replaced if the wine of new life is to expand. So I believe, Lord, help my unbelief, that I may have courage to keep trying when I'm tired and to keep wanting passionately when I am found wanting. Oh God, I am so frail. My life spins like a top, bounced about by the clumsy hands of demands beyond my doing. Fanned by furies, at a pace but half a step from hysteria, so much to do, my days so few and fast spent, and I mostly unable to recall what I am rushing after. What can I believe except that beyond the limits of my little prayers and careful creeds, I am not meant for dust and darkness, but for dancing life and silver starlight. Help my unbelief that I may have courage to dare to love the enemies I have the integrity to make, to care for little else save my brothers and sisters of the human family, to take time to be truly with them, take time to see, take time to speak, take time to learn with them before time takes us, and to fear failure and death less than the faithlessness of not embracing love's risks. God, I am so frantic. Somehow I've lost my gentleness in a flood of ambition, lost my sense of wonder in a maze of videos and computers, lost my integrity in a shuffle of commercial disguises, lost my gratitude in a swarm of criticisms and complaints, lost my innocence in a sea of betrayals and compromises. What can I believe except that the touch of your mercy will ease the anguish of my memory, that the tug of your spirit will empower me to help carry now the burdens I have loaded on the lives of others, that the example of Jesus will inspire me to find again my humanity. So I believe, Lord. Help my unbelief that I may have courage to cut free from what I have been and gamble on what I can be and on what you might laughingly do with trembling me for your incredible world. Any thoughts or reactions?
Well, I think I'd like to give one of your copies of that. That's pretty good.
15 cents upstairs.
That's all right. I'm quite happy to give you one of your copies.
What I would like to do is get all of your names who want a copy and get the book and the author and send it to you so that we reprint it with permission. Because I feel like we need to somehow acknowledge the source of this, and I can find it as soon as I get back to my office. So that's what I'd like to do, if that's all right with you. And I will have a paper up here afterwards to sign, and I would be glad to send you free copies. You don't even have to pay 15 cents postage. Any other comments about that reading, that prayer?
Well, you know, it speaks to the things that you lose as time goes on and your life progresses and your ambitions and what you have and how you try to maintain it and keep it, sort of block you from maybe some of your original intent and integrity. Mm-hmm. And I guess that happens to everybody. And of course, you know, having spent a week here and we had all this philosophical discussion and you live in a really nice environment, and now it's time to go home, and it's easy to start thinking about all those things. Mm-hmm. So I think they're kind of on everybody's mind going home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how you're going to melt this into your real life.
Mm-hmm. I've had different experiences taking different seminars where they're working on different parts of you, you know. It would be nice if you went to one place and got everything worked on all at once, you know, like your car, you get the tire fixed, and then you get the oil changed. But how do I describe? It was, I did not realize the impact of what I had experienced through the week, what I had heard or listened to, and then what I had digested. Because there's all that process of education. Mm-hmm. You can hear something, you can listen to it, but unless you've digested it, and that's a whole lifetime. Mm-hmm. That's a whole lifetime of change or challenge or whatever you want to look at it. The impact for me was with my immediate family. Because they've known me the longest, they've created the greatest judgments. That was the most challenging. I wouldn't say it's anything negative about it. It was just different. And I prefer to remain the same as I am. And my being is continually changing. I'm not doing it to offend anyone. So it can be a shock to the outside world when you've changed this week. You won't know until you get out there how much. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be fun. Just kind of think of it as a 10-year-old, like, don't forget, this is fun. Surprise! And then that's their problem. You know, you keep your own power, you keep your power. People have a tendency to want to take your power from you. And it's okay. It's just a natural human thing to change levels, to make a comfort zone, to keep the comfort zone. I don't know, am I making any sense?
Could you give an example maybe of something that in your life you think has changed that people will recognize, or either now or in the past?
My inner peacefulness, my calmness, because I have been very, very hyperactive. I am blessed with a lot of energy. That is a gift. Not everyone is the same, period. And if you have a whole lot of energy and some people don't, then it can be a real. So I guess in a way, you learn to shift gears. If you enter a room, keep quiet for a while and find out what's going on before you present yourself. Like I told Sherry, I said, I found out that I present myself in increments, because if I would just present myself totally, it's too much to grab.
Okay.
For me, it's easier to just kind of be mysterious, or, you know, observe. And then know what your environment is that you have entered.
Okay.
Because your presence is unique. Your presence, you will always make a change somewhere where you enter. It's like the pebble in the water. And like I said, it was my immediate family that it was my calmness and my quietness and yeah.
Okay.
And I would not tolerate certain things anymore. I say, you know, I can't accept this behavior, or I feel this way, or I hear you saying this. My approach to things in a discussion type things, in a sort of a resolving way, was different.
Okay, how is that related to the
church and singleness?
Yeah, to aging and economics, because I think there is a relationship there, and to the kind of the poetry that was just read.
I missed that.
Oh, okay. So you walked in after the poem.
Okay.
Okay.
I was reflecting on the topic singleness, aging, and economics, and I've been looking at the aging and economics part. And I mean, I'm going to some seminars and so forth because I'm very close to, you know, I'd take a very early retirement if I wish. And I got real second thoughts on that. But they haven't addressed much the singleness on that. But I was thinking a few weeks, the week before I came here and even in the weeks preceding, I'd been doing some prayer work with a young man who in the reserves had been hauled out and sent over to the Persian Gulf and was in the medical unit and cracked mentally under the what he was watching and had kind of high sensitivity to guilt and stuff. And he was back here and his wife is leaving him and he's going to be single and he's about 22, going to be single now, doesn't know where he's going in the economic world. And it's a whole new path, you know. And it's very scary walking out on that unknown path. And I reflected that I have been praying with him and trying to do some prayer treatment from the spiritual angle and letting him get help. Of course, he gets help where he needs it. And the psychiatric and the other things is that I find myself somewhat in the same situation. I find myself single and wondering, how is it to totally be taking care of yourself? And where are my economics go if I don't stay with the job I've got? and all these kind of things. And that was helpful because he began to see that all of us, and I saw that I still had, it seems as life moves on, you end up still having to walk out on this scary path. I thought that the 20s was the scariest time of my life and I never wanted to go back there again. I'm not sure that the scariest part of my life isn't still ahead of me.
Yeah.
And the simplest part is real scary to go into that path alone.
Yeah. To be single, moving along in years and not being quite sure what's coming next, and also being dependent on the system that's in place, not knowing whether that's going to change or not, so that even if you've gone along for many years assuming that some things will happen financially, perhaps the system will change somewhat and you will not be as secure as you thought you might have been as you continue to age. And it's not just a singleness issue, but I think it's an important one for those of us who are single because perhaps it is more scary. I don't know. I'd like to read just a brief piece from the National Catholic Reporter, and this, I think, was the March 22nd, 1991 issue. It says, political gains put nation's seniors at a loss. And I'd like to read this so that we all have a base from which to look at this issue of aging and economics and see some of the realities and then perhaps some more of the stories, the personal stories. These are statistical realities. I'm not going to read the first part of it, but I'll start in at about halfway through. It's one of those rare instances, said Arnold Bennett of Families USA, where people who think they know less actually know more. Bennett said most people's gut instinct about the elderly, that they are not an exceedingly wealthy segment of the population, is the correct impression. And numbers back up the argument. First, the elderly are more likely to live in poverty than any other adult age group. Next, 40% of the elderly can be classified as economically vulnerable, meaning they are uncomfortably close to poverty, according to a Families USA study. Further, while only 1 of 10 elderly whites lives below the poverty level, more than a third of elderly blacks and more than 20% of Hispanics fall below the federal poverty measure. And this one is the one that really I have a hard time believing, but the startling statistic, nearly 90% of elderly black women who live alone are classified as living below the poverty level or as economically vulnerable. That reality really, I heard this for the first time about a month ago at a national conference that I was attending, and I thought, wow, I mean, that is really a startling statistic. Minorities, said Samuel Simmons, president of the National Caucus on Black Aging, have unique problems that must be addressed. The notion that senior citizens are fat and sassy, said Simmons, is ageism, which is as bad as racism or sexism. Another factor in senior poverty is, as strange as it seems, age. The older people get, the more likely they are to be poor. Those older than 85, the fastest growing segment of the elderly, are often the poorest. And as some elderly advocates are quick to point out, several reasons, most notably access to health care, keep many elderly from sliding downward economically. A single illness can wipe out a lifetime of savings. Mm-hmm. Out-of-pocket costs for health care, that is, those not covered by Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance, average $2,400 annually for seniors. The senior groups are no strangers to healthcare lobbying. The political fallout over the last healthcare battle, which pitted seniors against seniors, may have more to do with the success or failure of program expansions than the merits or faults of any particular plan. That battle was Ronald Reagan's 1987 proposed catastrophic healthcare initiative to cover seniors who suffer short-term but costly acute care crises. Everyone cheered. The legislation, well, that is expanded and changed as it made its way through Congress, passed. It was the largest expansion of medical benefits in this country since Medicare and Medicaid were instituted. But there was one problem. Wealthy seniors who already had private coverage for acute care, but who paid for the new program through increased Medicare premiums and a surtax, did not want the coverage. They revolted. Hundreds of thousands of angry letters to Congress made for a congressional first. In 1989, Congress repealed the legislation. Federally sponsored catastrophic health insurance ceased to exist. I'm not going to read the rest of it, but I think that sort of lays out the scenario, one of the scenarios, for aging and economics, because as we know, one of the biggest costs as we age is going to be health care, and particularly as singles, we may need to really give that some added thought.
One of the statistics that came up, I do a telemarketing thing for the Domestic Abuse Center in Seattle, which is the foundation of this particular type of thing, where they have funds to support people who are educated in social work for domestic violence and sexual abuse. And one of the statistics that came up was that Seattle has almost as large a bag lady, quote unquote, as say Las Vegas or some of the other, and you know, population-wise, it's not that big, but that's scary.
Okay, that's one piece of the poverty issue, and even if you know, depending on the age, as I look around the room, some of us are young, some are middle-aged, some are older. Regardless of where we fall in this spectrum, we may have concerns about our own aging. We also may have concerns about parents who may be still alive and they're aging. And some of those parents may be single. Some of us as singles may be responsible for helping to make decisions and helping to care for. There's an issue if we are single and are not yet in an age category where we may be able to retire, and yet we have a single aging parent who needs care. What impact does that have on us, even if we are not yet reaching that point? What impact does that have? Does that mean we quit a job to care for an aging parent who may need care? Just, are there any personal experiences, either with your own aging, with the aging of a person close to you, that has impacted you that you'd like to share?
I guess I have a real comfortable experience with that. My parents are both almost 80, and my husband's parents are in their 90s, and both of them in fine health, both couples, they're both alive. They, you know, take care of themselves. They're not. So I feel like I've been in a kind of a bubble situation. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to worry about me. Mm-hmm. And 3 years ago, when I became the sort of the breadwinner for the family, when before that I was feeling like anything I brought home was gravy. You know, mm-hmm. I could work if I wanted to, if I did and I didn't have to. A job was something that I chose to do and I didn't have to. Kind of arrogant about it, maybe to a certain extent. When I suddenly 3 years ago became the financial responsible person for the family, it was terrifying for me. I had never been in a situation like that. And I started reading magazines like Modern Maturity, which I think is an excellent magazine.
Sure.
And sitting in on things at the school system where I work on retirement and money markets, and I mean, it just suddenly, you know, I would say just the last few years, it's just like my antennas came up. Mm-hmm. And thought, this is reality.
Yeah, it really is.
And I was, like I say, I was maybe living in this little bubble situation, mm-hmm. assuming that my spouse was going to be there and take care of these things. And, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Howard?
I'm thinking of two sides of it. Just almost exactly 3 years ago, I buried my mother at age 91. And the three previous years to that, I was looking after her and watching this path of going down. She was a single person and in a retirement home, then becoming intermediate care, then becoming full care, and all the things that go. And watching the financial picture get slimmer and slimmer until she's finally qualified for Medicaid. And then you wouldn't believe the confusions that go on in that process. I still don't believe it. But and then she finally dies. And then I think of myself, I've got quite a few years to go before that, before reaching her maximum age. But I'm thinking, as I leave Holden Village, it would be nice to go back to Seattle and have some semblance of something that resembles Holden Village. And I'm suggesting that for single people between the ages of 60 and 75, I don't know where you find anything that has the slightest resemblance to Holden Village. Am I just blind?
You mean in terms of support?
In terms of keeping your mind and your creative part, as well as your fellowship with other single people in this age. I'm fairly close to 75, almost 73, and I don't, but for that whole gap of that period of 60 to 75, where do these people go? What usually happens, I'm afraid, is that they just sort of diminish as persons. They become lonely, they're less energy, they can't go places, they watch television, they just turn it off.
Arizona.
That's the wealthy ones.
Yeah, that's
the wealthy ones.
The wealthy ones have the
TV or liquor, one or the other.
But do not have a condominium where a lot of provided. I know Denver have one, and they have every kind of facility for what we have here.
That's if you have money.
No, it's such a money place. I think it costs about $80,000 to buy in there.
Well, that's money.
Mm-hmm. But that's a lot money. Of people have a home.
Yeah.
That's supposed to practice that price. They're much more reasonable now, I understand. I think they're in their $70,000. But they just provide everything.
I think another wonderful thing about Holden here is that it's a community of many generations, and there's not a lot of distinction right. made among the generations that. Dancing last night,
mm-hmm.
and the woman in a wheelchair, and everybody was dancing. And I think the churches seem to be a place, mm-hmm. one of the few institutions where all these age groups are brought together. But it's very common for churches to have. We have an over 55ers club, and
they're nearly all coupled.
But we could do more, I think, to have intergenerational.
And we have
it's kind of strange that they have an not strange, but it's neat. They have an intergenerational coordinator here, but there's so many things that are intergenerational just by default.
But Howard's question is still, how do we find this?
Mm-hmm.
Where do we find this when we leave here?
So the churches seem to be a logical place, but churches need some work.
Minnesota has some places like that too, if I remember. I'm not interested in living in those places, but I have friends that live in, I forgot what they're called, Friendship Village. And everything is like, I guess, the Denver condominiums.
But it's not intergenerational, is it?
No.
It's very retirement.
Yeah.
And kind of spreading the word or whatever. Is helpful, I think. as I sort of project my own life, and I keep going, oh, well, gee, you know, I'm doing fine now, but what about that time when I want to have a Thanksgiving dinner and I'm 75 and there's no one to come? And then I sit and think, well, you know, all
that won't happen. Won't happen if you don't let it happen.
Right, and that's what I think. I think, you know, I wake up and I've always been able to surround myself with friends and support systems. Why should I worry that down the line I'm not going to be able to do that?
Yeah, well, don't think about it.
But yet again, I think that it still takes some sort of preparation and some energy at various levels to maintain those support systems and even to project down the line to where you might be. And I know for myself, I just bought my first home, and that's all exciting in itself, but it kind of closed a door for me in that I had sort of entertained ideas of intentional communities or, you know, establishing at this point in my life something that may provide some of the things that this gentleman might be looking for further down the line by virtue of having started that process now. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think just by kind of thinking about who you are and where you're headed is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is helpful. There's a poem that I found this morning. I was looking through this book called Songs of Experience, an anthology of literature on growing old, edited by Margaret Fowler and Priscilla McCutcheon. And it this she well I'm not sure where they're from, but this poem was written by Marilyn Zuckerman, who has had a long career as writer and publisher. In the 1970s, she received appointments in the New Hampshire Council of the Arts, poet in the schools program, and as poet artist in residence for the Massachusetts Arts and Humanities Foundation. And the poem is entitled After 60. And I think it speaks somewhat to what you're saying, Howard. The sixth decade is coming to an end. Doors have opened and shut. The great distractions are over. Passion, children, the long indenture of marriage. I fold them into a chest. I will not take with me when I go. Everyone says the world is flat and finite on the other side of 60, that I will fall clear off the edge into darkness, that no one will hear from me again or want to. But I am ready for the knife slicing into the future, for the quiet that explodes inside, to join forces with the strong old woman, to throw everything away and begin again. Now there is time to tell the story, time to invent the new one, time to chain myself to a fence outside the missile base, to throw my body before a truck loaded with phallic images, to write Thou Shalt Not Kill on the hull of a Trident submarine, to pour my own blood on the walls of the Pentagon, to walk 1,000 miles with a begging bowl in my hand. There are places on this planet where women pass the menopause, put on the tribal robes, smoke pipes of wisdom, fly. I don't know if any of you have comments, but that really struck a chord in me again, that...
That reminds me of, I'm sure many people here are familiar with Ruth Yarndahl Nelson. I don't know
her.
But there was, she was in the protesting having the Trident subs in...
That's right.
...in Seattle or something like that.
That's right.
She passed away a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
and she was an elderly woman now. Famous in the ALC, I guess. And she had gone out to protest these nuclear subs, these subs with nuclear missiles.
Yeah.
And she was out in they knew there was going to be some kind of protest. She was out in a rubber raft, and the Navy was prepared to defend in some way these people. They were going out in the rubber rafts to kind of inhibit their maneuvers. And she's out there in this rubber dinghy, and she had some kind of physical ailment that she needed her meth. I don't know what she was diabetic or she had some. Anyway, she had all her medicine there too in case something happened. And they come up near the submarine, and there's a young sailor with a water cannon on board the submarine, ready to repel this dinghy, and here's this elderly woman in the boat, and she says, "Not in my America, you don't." Yeah, she didn't do anything.
She had a son that was a pastor, I think in Seattle too, that protected her. You know, they didn't want to cope with her.
There's actually a video that shares that story.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that a couple of years ago. It's really quite a story, and she was quite a woman.
She's of the Youngdahl family.
Mm-hmm.
One of Minnesota's famous families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that gives us a positive image of aging and what aging can be all about. And I love it when I find little stories and pieces that can give us that positive image that we need as we move into later years. And one of the pieces that's really important, I think, again, Howard and Mark, you've alluded to that intergenerational piece that's really incredibly important, not only for those of us who are aging, but also for the younger generation that needs the wisdom and the experience that's passed on. And if we don't make that happen intentionally in our society right now, it's hard to have that happen. And that it has implications for economics as well as just the emotional process.
You know, I was talking to you earlier, Sherry, and I was telling you how angry my husband is at his father, who's in his 90s, and my husband's 55, because he has done well in his life. Financially, he's done well. With his career, he's done well, family-wise and stuff. And John feels very angry at his father because he feels like he's lost everything at the age he is, that he's not been able to be a good dad, be a good husband, manage money. And he's real angry at his dad for not teaching him the things that were important to him that mm-hmm. made him get into old age gracefully with mm-hmm. the same family, with financial security, you know, these kinds of things. And I think when you said, you know, we need to get some of this and pass it on to our next generation, I think that's true. What good is the knowledge if we're not able to share it, mm-hmm. you know, with our, if we don't, of course, as a child, I think we have responsibility to go to our parents and say, how'd you do it? You know, it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
Or you can just hold it inside and just be.
How many of us really do that? I mean, how many of us intentionally make that effort to cross generational lines to do that kind of learning and growing? I mean, I think it's relatively rare that we actually take the time to do that.
Mm.
You want to share?
Two big walks. Mm-hmm. I walked with Soviets when they were here in 88, 250. We slept in tents, 250 Americans, 250 Soviets. We all walked from Los Angeles to San Francisco, walk and bus. And last year I joined the group, and there were all ages. Every kind of age was on the beach. They came right from, well, they came, you name it. That came from every corner of California to join the group. And last year we walked for the environment, and I couldn't walk very far last year because I'd had foot surgery. And unfortunately, the doctor told me I'd be well, but I wasn't. So I had to go home after about 3-4 weeks. And we slept in tents out at Simi Valley. It was tough going. I found frost on my tent flap the first Friday. And that wasn't too pleasant. But, and then we had lots of, you just have to, but older people are resistant, are strong and are able to handle situations more than I think are young people.
Well, I think that you're making a really good point, and you've made the effort to go out there and do things. I think, by and large, in our culture here in this country, except for the Native Americans and except for the Black community, perhaps the Hispanic community somewhat. I even have to include the Asian Americans, who also respect and try to intentionally learn from their elders. They, the white population in this society has not done a real good job of revering and respecting the gifts that our older adults have to pass on.
I found that true in traveling in Europe. So, the young people have a different, it's a whole different attitude young people have to older, for older people in the European countries, mm-hmm. even in China. They
yeah.
just venerate older people.
So
we're just sort of passed by.
That's right. We need
necessarily, not as older for sure.
Even at Holden, I had the privilege of teaching at Elder Hostel last week, and some of the comments from the participants in that program were that they really wished that the young people would have taken time to pay attention and talk with them. Even at mealtime, they seemed to be segregated, and perhaps that was because the Elder Hostel group was always doing things in a group, and there wasn't as much opportunity as we have when things are more, or I was going to say less structured, but it still seems fairly structured. But you know, perhaps it was idiosyncratic to that particular group, but. You know, even here, that was part of their concern, that they weren't able to have that intergenerational contact that they really wanted. They had hoped they could do some of that. What I want to share before we go any further, just so everybody gets the opportunity to see this, you can have these. Talking about this intergenerational sharing and also about the implications for economics. I'll pass these out. These are values history forms. And you may take them with you and use them in any way you want. You can copy them. They're not copyrighted, however, it's important to give credit to if you use them to the originator of these forms. It's Joan MacIver Gibson, and it was developed at the Institute of Public Law, University of New Mexico, through a grant from Idelson Foundation. They want people to pass this on. This is an intentional way of getting that intergenerational contact going, to share values and attitudes about how one has lived one's life, to share healthcare kinds of choices, has a lot of implications for life and death decisions later on, if those are necessary, or even if they're necessary, many young people are faced with life and death decisions, but it's particularly an issue of singleness and aging, because we may not have really spent time talking to somebody about how we want to age, how we want to be cared for, if it comes to the point where we need to be cared for, how we want those decisions to be made, if there's a question about whether to pull the plug or discontinue certain kinds of care. There's all kinds of implications here, and this form is a way to encourage communication. There's two forms there, actually. One of them can be used between any two people, or actually you can even fill it out yourself if you want to, but it's more fun if you make the connections. I mean, that's part of the intent of it. But the other one is intended for adolescents. The second one is intended for adolescents to fill out themselves and then interview an older adult. It could be an older adult friend or relative. It could be a parent, a grandparent. And it's a way to really get at some of those values issues. And I think when we look at at some of the implications of the cost of healthcare, the cost of care in institutions. Well, one of the statistics that we know is that I think it's only about 5% of our population over 65 is being cared for in institutions. So 95% of the caregiving happens outside of institutions. Now, the percentage, that's the percentage over 65. If we keep going up, the percentage over 85 of that 5% is a great large percentage, of course. The older one gets, the more likely it may be that there's institutional care. But we still have a huge percentage, and that has both economic and emotional kinds of implications for us as we age, for ourselves, and also if we're not quite there yet, for aging parents and other relatives.
Is this a law, or is this a program in most states? I understand in Minnesota, many people who normally would be in a rest home are staying in their homes, and public health nurses are being provided to go into the home and take care of them a portion of each day.
I think across the country we're finding that there's all kinds of alternatives beginning to spring up, because as we age in this day and age, we don't become frail usually until we're quite old, so that, as Howard was suggesting, between the ages of 60 and 75, for instance, and in many, many cases even older than that, we have very active older adults who are just looking for things to do. And so we've now got springing up all around the country folks in that age category who have retired from whatever their occupation may have been, looking for opportunities to volunteer, not only caring for older adults even than them, but looking for intergenerational opportunities to be in volunteer kinds of situations. Yes.
And it was in the Seattle paper recently about story about how they have a program now for elderly people who have their own home, but are kind of, it's a rough kind of thing that they're maintaining in terms of the maintenance, the shopping, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And there's a program where they connect people who are maybe students or younger people who can come into
yes.
the home
yes.
and live within the home. And yeah. I thought an interesting thing too, to even throw out to a group of single people, was perhaps the idea of having an elderly person come in to live with you, even what you were describing to me mm-hmm. last night in terms of your living situation, mm-hmm. of having when you think about roommates or housemates, that think mm-hmm. intergenerational, mm-hmm. and that there's mm-hmm. a lot of, if you really start
there's
about,
a lot of value.
Benefits to
yeah.
it.
For everybody involved, there really is. There's also house sharing programs, you know, that can be entered into by older adults who are still fairly active but need some level of care, and there are perhaps professionals who move in and out of those situations as needed. There's all kinds of alternatives. Do any of you have any personal experience with any of those sorts of programs? Or those kinds of things are definitely going on, and those are the kinds of things we need to be thinking more about and creating. As Howard was questioning, where can I find something when I go back?
Well, what I'm doing now, I have a Sunday school class that's intergenerational, and I'm usually the only old person there. And then I have a Monday night discussion group that's, once more, I'm the only old person. And this is great, you know, to share. And then I have a couple of men's groups mm-hmm. that are seniors Wednesday night and Friday morning. But the I still haven't found any group that would be stimulating my mind mm-hmm. that would include a number of people between 60 and 75. I'm usually mm-hmm. the only one in that age.
In our community, we have something called RSVP, and I don't know if that's a national type thing, Retired Seniors Volunteer Program, maybe that's what it is. And gosh, these people are the most active, other than probably the hospital auxiliary ladies who are always, you know, you get a volunteer and you've got twice a worker, then you have a paid one almost. And these people do fantastic things. And for my daughter, who lives quite a ways away from her grandparents, I finally called her one day because she misses having a grandparent relationship. And I just said, could there be a foster grandparent type thing? So she has a grandfather who picks her up on a motorcycle. He's 70. And the grandmother who helps her made a quilt, a lap quilt, before she came here the day. And, you know, calls my grandma and grandpa close, and we have them over for supper once in a while, have a barbecue, and we've done fun things, and they get special hugs in church and stuff. And they do all sorts of things for some people that even look younger than them sometimes. I mean, older people who maybe don't experience the same health. And, you know, and there are single and married couples. It makes mm-hmm. a difference. And then we have a gathering form, a volunteer RSVP volunteer banquet that someone puts on, and they pay for it. One of the churches or something supplies all the food, but it's paid for. And they have, you know, a Christmas party for them, and they have an appreciation banquet for them, and have a program and things. So something like that maybe would work for you, Holly.
Well, I think I'm serving to the extent of my energy. But I'm still not finding.
But maybe you need to drop some of those other things if they're not being with people your age group and get involved.
Well, the volunteer process still doesn't give me a stimulating group experience that yeah. I'm talking about.
Yeah, through the National Interfaith Coalition on Aging, which is now part of the. Let me see if I can get it right. The no, it's well. Anyway, we've just recently the National Interfaith Coalition on Aging has just recently been taken into the I don't remember now the National Council on Aging, and they've got a wonderful program called Discovery Through the Humanities, and it's just this wonderful set of materials that can be borrowed from them if you can find a group of other folks who are interested in learning. It's just a wonderful, stimulating kind of curriculum, sort of. And I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but there's lots of different topics. And it would mean trying to find a group that would be willing to enter in onto that.
Got a couple suggestions. I've already mentioned some before. You may have to invent your own group to a certain extent. In the Twin Cities area, we do have a Singles All Together group, which is a large number of people who get together around certain activities that they enjoy, and they also have weekly meetings. Those activities range from everything from hiking, canoeing, to bridge, to computers. Yeah, Edina, the Colonial Church of Edina.
800.
And so if you would join a group like that, and you start your own special, what they call a special interest group, and you advertise for other people that would be also interested in meeting once a month for conversation about whatever. The other idea is, if you're interested in a lot of intellectual conversation, is Mensa, which is an organization for people who are have scored high in the percentile on nationwide recognized intelligence tests. And they also have specialty groups. There are biker mm-hmm. Mensas, there are chess Mensas, there are all kinds of Mensa special interest groups. So that would be another resource for any single person, actually, to get involved.
I think you can do it in a small church. I belong to this church, and we have $1 million budget. But on the other hand, Christ Presbyterian Church has a program like this. You have to have a one church, they just come in from, you name it, every denomination. Yeah.
So one of the things may be ecumenical kinds of things, community-based things. Mark.
Another thing about Holden is really special, not just because you might feel welcome as a senior here, but the distinctions don't seem to be made that much. One of the things that I like being here is back in my small town of St. Peter, Minnesota, I think very aware that I'm a single person, that I'm in my late 30s and I'm not married yet. What's the matter with you? I don't have kids yet, and the young families that have kids that are 2 to 5, they hang out with each other, and the young married couples that don't have kids, they hang out with each other. And what's so refreshing about Holden is being in a place where those kind of distinctions don't seem to matter. Mm-hmm. So rather than, I would say, looking for, you know, other seniors or other singles that have something in common, you go out and join the Sierra Club, or you join the Greens, or you join some group that you like, and have that activity be the thing that brings you together, rather than your
age or marital status.
Classification.
Yeah. That works for everybody better than almost anything.
Anybody can find a group, every city.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to close. I've enjoyed spending the time with you this week, and I hope that some of you are able to come back again next year.